Hi, thanks for tuning in. This is Mike Spivey. I'm here with Scott Moss. Scott Moss is a faculty member at Colorado Law School and the chair of the Faculty Admissions Committee. And I'm a partner of the Spivey Consulting Group. We do law school admissions help for prospective students, and we consult for law schools. And we speak at different colleges around the nation about how to get into law school. But once a year, this is our third year, Scott and I get together, not frequently enough, but we do get together once a year.
And it's a good excuse to chat about what we do for a living, what we know.
Right. And do a post-US News World Report Law School Rankings podcast. What's of interest this year, I think, to a lot of our listeners is going to be that we're not going to just talk about US News World Report. We'll start with that. But we're going to hopefully spend a good amount of time speaking about why people should select, how and why people select what schools to apply to, and then how and why they distill that list down to what schools they want to matriculate at. This is acutely in my mind right now because I have a number of clients with a number of offers, and how do they compare an offer at Stanford or Harvard with no merit aid versus a full ride at Chicago or Columbia or UVA, for example. And so we'll talk a little bit about that. I think I'm going to start off speaking. For the first time, I have a nice history of law school rankings. It dates back to 1890s. This is from a wonderful journal article in the Indiana Law Journal. There were three faculty members who wrote this. It's about a, 100-page article. William Henderson, who is at Indiana. Andrew Morris, so Dean Morris is the dean of Texas A&M Law School, which is it's a relatively new law school. It's an old law school that Texas A&M is part of their system now. And then Fumi, is that right?
Fumi Arewa.
Fumi from Irvine. So they got together and did sort of a meta analysis of the history of law schools. It's certainly well sourced, hundreds upon hundreds of sources. And the theme of the history, which is probably not surprising, is that not only have people categorized and then later ordinarily ranked law schools, since essentially when law schools became a thing, not necessarily when they were founded, but when they became a thing, I'll talk about that. Not only have they categorized them and ranked them, but the rankings haven't really changed. The name of this article is Enduring Hierarchies in American Legal Education. The hierarchies have endured. So let me just briefly, because I think it's fascinating and I hope other people do too, let me briefly just talk about the history. So what happened? In the 19th century, there about one in every five lawyers went to law school. So there were law schools. They were mostly for undergraduates, and they were very vocational, trade-oriented. So they were essentially apprenticeships. There was no standardization in any shape or form of how things were taught. It was an apprenticeship. Around the turn of the century, into the 19th century, Harvard introduced the case method. And they introduced the case method because of this lack of standardization, which to me makes sense. So there's it's a wild, wild west. People are teaching one thing, one school over from the next. And Harvard said, well, we need to have a scientific method to instructing people in the law. And after Harvard did it, it entirely caught on. And other schools said, that's a great idea. We're going to follow suit. With that shift, then you saw faculty members start specializing in just law school, and law was no longer an undergraduate major. It became or undergraduate academic program. It became a graduate program with people specifically training to teach law. Welcome, faculty. Scott's going to pay attention to what I say now. So faculty start specializing in law. I apologize if this is going to sound like I'm blaming law faculty. I'm doing is sourcing the timeline.
And that's saying, fine. We probably deserve it.
Yeah. Okay. So with this introduction of people specifically, law school specifically teaching the case method in a scientific method, and faculty members specifically training to teach law at the graduate level, you immediately saw legal scholars, for example, Redlich, I can't remember, Joseph Redlich, dividing American legal education into groups. Redlich divided them into two groups, an academic-oriented and a practice-oriented. And I like what, I don't necessarily like what he says, but I like to note what he says. So Redlich suggested, and I quote, that the lesser of the two groups have not the slightest significance from the point of view of scientific legal instruction. Okay, so we already have a greater and a lesser. This persists, and it starts being no one's ranking them ordinally, but there starts being winners and losers in the prestige game. And mostly it involved resources. Let me tell you the names of the schools that had dramatically higher tuition, and you tell me if these names, make a mental note if these names sound familiar. Harvard, Yale, Columbia, Penn, Chicago charged dramatically more for entering students to tuition. So, right? Harvard, Yale, Columbia, Penn, Chicago. We're talking the schools ranked 2, 4, 4, 7 in the rankings today. As early as 1914, we're charging more in tuition. It became about a couple things. Schools started, it became about the scholarship of the faculty and how that overlaid with the scientific method. And as early as the 1950s, believe it or not, well before U.S. News World Report rankings, law schools were buying students. 80% of aid that went out in the 1950s was either entirely merit-based or a combination of merit plus need. Only 20% of scholarships or aid that went out in the 1950s was need-based. So there's a lot of people think that with the introduction of the U.S. News World Report rankings, we've created an arms race. And in some sense, we have, because of different atmospheric factors. But there was an arms race going on for faculty talent and student talent well before U.S. News World Report ever thought about rankings, probably before U.S. News World Report existed. I don't know when they existed, but...
Yeah, certainly nobody paid as much attention until the rankings, at least in the law school world. You know, I hadn't known most of this, but this is example 7,042 of how nothing ever changes in the world. You know, we're not going to talk about the 2016 presidential race, but when everybody's talking about how wacky it is, no, it's not. Nothing changes. In 1848, the Whigs called presidential candidate Lewis Cass a, quote, pot-bellied, mutton-headed cucumber, close quote. And in 1928, Jackson supporters accused John Quincy Adams of having premarital sex with his wife, seemingly not that scandalous, but also of being a pimp. So, you know,
in 1928,
really anything that you're shocked, anything that we report to be outraged by today, law deans are outraged by the U.S. News rankings, we're outraged by how harsh the presidential rankings are. Well, law deans aren't calling each other pimps or pot-bellied, mutton-headed cucumbers.
As far as we know.
As far as we know, right.
So things haven't changed. The rankings haven't changed. I put about a 5-minute drive from where I live to Colorado Law School of thought into why rankings matter so much. We could have Googled it. I am sure there are all articles on it. Please Google it and you can email it to me, mike@spivyconsulting.com. My best guess is rankings matter because you are, at every microsecond, taking in way too much data on the world around you. And it's not organized and it's overbearing, wouldn't even be the right word.
Yeah, it's all the psychology and social science and behavioral economics scholarship about how you need to order the world in some simplified way, because I remember applying to law schools many years ago, and it was when there were rankings, but they weren't as ubiquitous. So there was a bit more of, oh, who knows how you choose among these schools. And in a sense, it's comforting to have some way to rank order them. So if you don't have the U.S. News rankings, you have what I remember when I was applying to law schools, most of them in New York. What you do is you ask around some lawyers you know. They have some even more arbitrary ranking in their head, where there was a consensus. I remember this is as of the mid-late 90s. People thought Columbia and NYU were the top two schools, then Fordham. And then what school was number four depended on where you knew a guy who went there. So if you're a lawyer around town in New York and you knew a guy who went to St. John's and you liked him, thought he was a good lawyer, you'd probably think they're the fourth best school. However, if you knew a guy from St. John's and you thought he was a pot-bellied mutton cucumber, then you would probably say St. John's is terrible and the fourth best school is Brooklyn or Cardozo or Hofstra, right? And you literally would get five different answers to what's the fourth best school in New York in the late 90s when the rankings were less ubiquitous. So without the rankings, people just go by arbitrary rankings based on what they heard from a guy. So it's not as though without the rankings we'd be in a more logical world. We'd just be in a world of less information.
So exactly. Rankings are here to stay. Right, we're not going to overcome human nature. Certainly, Scott and I aren't saying U.S. News and World Report has it right. No one can have it right. To begin with, schools have different missions. You can't rank everyone ordinally on the same scale because schools have different missions. Prospective students and students have different desired outcomes. So there's no ranking that's going to get it right. And certainly, U.S. News and World Report probably puts too much emphasis on prestige. But that's part of this enduring hierarchy. I think what this article, the journal article I read, would contend is that faculty have always put too much emphasis on prestige. Does it matter? Yeah, prestige parallels career outcomes very neatly. So we're not here to say rankings are good and bad. I will say this, and I was just having a conversation with a client of mine choosing between schools, and this is the direction eventually Scott and I are going to go in, and we were talking about some of the differences between some of the top 10 schools and the top 20 schools. I, in my heart of hearts, I believe this. Rankings do not reflect well the caliber of the student. Okay? Maybe, well, not to offend anyone, but I would agree that at the very top, there might be a strong difference in the caliber of students than at a non-ranked school. I mean, that's, having done admissions for most of my career, I would be hard-pressed to be swayed of that. But the standard measurement of error is the estimate or measurement for the LSAT. Which one do they, same difference?
Either.
Yeah. So it's 2 point, the most recent, LSAC tells us that the most recent standard estimate of error for the LSAT is 2.6. Right before that, it was 2.7. What that generally means is that when you take the LSAT, if you get a 167, on any given test, LSAC is telling us that you could have had a 170 or a 164. That's within the likelihood of your test day performance. That syncs up very well with anecdotal. My former boss was at Harvard and then he went to Vanderbilt. And one of the things I remember him saying was that over time being in Vanderbilt, he noticed no real difference between the Vanderbilt students and the Harvard students. When I went to Vanderbilt to Wash U, to me, there was absolutely no discernible difference between the students. When I went from Wash U to Colorado, there was no discernible difference. The students seemed just as engaged, just as sharp, and on any given day, you almost could have flopped up a lot of these students.
And that's partly because if you're talking about the first tier of schools or so, you're talking about students who are in the 160s to low 170s in LSAT on average. But a score in the low 160s, I forget the exact number, is the 90th percentile nationally.
Right, right, right.
So you're talking about very fine differences. It's the difference between, you know, A minuses and A's, basically. So that's what's kind of minute. So, you know, with that, a lot of you, I imagine, wanted to hear about our take or just opinions about schools that moved this year. So to start with that, one thing I'll say is this. Every year, you know, I chair the admissions committee, I talk to some number of applicants, happy to do so. The one question that makes me want to tear out some of my hair is, I see your school moved up or down two or three places mm-hmm. this year. Now, I can say this with some authority that I'm not just exercising a grudge here, because Colorado moved zero this past year.
That's correct.
But A year where we moved up three, the number of students who were impressed by that was much higher than it should have been. That is to say, the number of students that should have been impressed is about zero. Because there's such flux in the rankings, they tweak the formula, a change of 0.01 affects it. I can say confidently that if some school moved 2 to 4 spots, you should basically completely ignore that. So the hilarious thing that actually got attention on blogs was that Michigan moved up 3 and Duke moved down 3, so they swapped spots. I can assure you that there's no difference between Michigan and Duke that the rankings can gather about A, how good schools they are, they're basically equal, and B, I assume that really means nothing. So I think there's a lot that you can ignore in this. One other thing I'll say, and this is an opinion I don't know if you share, Mike, is that I'm not a fan of the specialty rankings whereby some school is top X. I can tell you how that comes about. If there's a specialty, just to make up one, in admiralty and maritime law, just to pick one that doesn't exist, here's how you get your specialty ranking there. What you do is you send glossy mailers to the chairs in admiralty and maritime law and the endowed professors to say that we have a great program in admiralty and maritime law. Literally, schools market themselves to other schools. Some schools do this to move in the rankings generally. It works better, though, within the specialty ranks. So a lot of that is just an arms race of marketing the schools do to each other to increase their reputation among other professors. I can assure you that as a student, it bears no relevance to you whether a professor at Colorado is impressed with the specialty program of another school or not. So I think the specialty ranking is, as take it for what it's worth, it means the school is trying to have somewhat more professors in the field than some others, but you probably already knew that because any school that's ranked in, just to pick a field, health law, you know, you already knew that they had a health law program because you saw it on the website, so you haven't really learned anything other than that they're trying to pitch themselves in that field.
I would even add that in my academic career, my administrative career in legal education, rankings was something that I had a play in. And I remember reading a researched article by a law faculty member that said that that the length of the it's called law porn. This is getting really phallic.
It's not what you think. Here, bear them out.
Right. If you send out a biannual report to other law schools about your law school, there was a correlation in prestige movement with the length of that report.
Literally, there's one law school, I shouldn't name names, and I won't for this one. The administration of a law school sent a viewmaster, most of you are too young to know what that is, to deans of other law schools bragging about their new faculty. So if I were a law applicant and I heard that a school were doing this, I would think that is a colossal waste of money for a law school to be mailing viewmasters to 200 law deans around the country in boxes so that those deans will think well of them in the U.S. News rankings. So, yeah, that's the sort of nonsense. Now, what rankings movements...
Well, hey, let me add one thing. If it works, it works. So maybe...
If it works, it works. But, you know, I'd say what movements in the rankings can you trust? I'd say if there's a really big jump in the rankings, that could well mean something. It could mean that the school had a big influx of money, so it is buying better resources, more faculty, more scholarships for students, better students with scholarships. So there's some schools that I don't know what went on there, like Cincinnati moved up 22, but good for them. You know, they probably are doing something about right. That's a major jump. There are some jumps that reflect that a school recovered from a drop. So take UC Hastings that went up 9. Well, Hastings had been ranked in the 30s in the not too distant past. They took a terrific hit when the Bay Area had a worse form of the economic crash than others, and the UCs lost some resources. But it reminds me a bit of what in baseball writer and analyst Bill James called the plexiglass principle, which is that if you experience too big a rise or a fall, there's going to be a tendency to bounce back. Because you probably shouldn't have dropped from 38 to 62 or whatever it is the Hastings dropped to. So take it for what it's worth that Hastings bounced back to 50. They're still a first-year school. And the drop of recent years probably overstated how big a hit they took when the job market cratered and they lost some resources and had to charge greater tuition than they used to. So that's my take, is you could trust the big jumps upward as either they're doing something right, or to pick another school that I'll compliment, is Indiana is a school that has gotten some big donations, is doing some things right, so they probably deserve to have jumped 9 spots to 25 as they did.
Yeah, and with the plexiglass theory, that segue that syncs up well with this enduring hierarchy theme. You may have a good year or a bad year. The U.S. News and World Report may change the metrics. They really didn't change the metrics much last year. The only thing I saw was the 10 years out employment versus 10 months out versus 9 months out. Scott mentioned something that reminded me of a bunch of emails I get. Every year, the day after the rankings are publicly released, I get some emails saying, ooh, is this dean going to be gone? And there's a lot of media sensationalism about deans being fired or not having their contracts re-upped after a drop in the rankings. I think that is way overly sensationalized. But I will say this, if you think about it at another level, the U.S. News World Report rankings reflect data. Some of the data they reflect is admissions data. And if over a 3 or 4 year tenure of the dean at your school, your admissions numbers are getting worse, if over a 3 or 4 year tenure at your school, your faculty prestige is getting worse and you're not bringing in new faculty members and keeping fresh blood in the faculty, then you very well may be fired. Because the things that U.S. News and World Report is measuring are things that provosts and presidents and boards of law schools care about. So my point is this, because I get so many of these emails, if a school goes down in the rankings, down in the wrong direction from 30 to 40 1 year, I really don't see a situation where that would lend itself to a strong push for the dean to be fired. Maybe if the dean and the provost doesn't get along, it might be a reason behind it. But if a school is getting, if their metrics are losing out to their competition 3, 4, 5 years in a row, it might have nothing to do with U.S. News and World Report other than they're tracing the same metrics that the school cares about.
Right, which is to say that schools are doing the same exercise we're doing, is trying to figure out whether a drop they've had is really the fault of the dean, the leadership decisions they're making. It's often not, but sometimes it is. One other area I'll say where I would say the rankings do capture something real, in addition to what I just mentioned, which is that substantial rises can reflect a recovery after a drop, as Hastings, or doing something right, like Indiana, or it might be an indication that you don't know exactly what they're doing, but it's going well, like Cincinnati. There's another area where I'll believe a drop, which is that there can be regional effects, in that one of the big inputs, there are three big categories of inputs that really matter for the rankings based on the weights U.S. News gives. One is reputation, that's hard to move. One is admissions data, and another is job data. Job data can really correlate with regions. So, for example, there really seems to be a New York effect in recent years. Columbia and NYU are doing fine. They're not going to notice any national trends. They're in the top 4 to 6. But Fordham is about where it was. It's down 3 at 37. It's been as high as the high 20s. So maybe they've had a tick of a dropward movement, but not much. But then the other New York schools have really overall substantially gotten clobbered. It wasn't too long ago that Brooklyn and Cardozo were ranked 50 to in the 50s. And each of them had this meme that they were going to overtake the other and catch up to Fordham. That didn't happen. And right now, Brooklyn's 97 and Cardozo's 74. St. John's bounced up 8 to 74, but they bounced around there. But there are a bunch of other schools. Hofstra used to be in the top 100, no longer is. Pace and Albany have dropped. CUNY has dropped a bit. I don't know that that reflects anything wrong any of these schools are doing. I just suspect that there's a regional effect, either tough job market of the past several years in New York, taking a little longer to climb out of the recession, or that New York may be a little oversaturated. So you can believe rankings movement if it reflects oversaturation or a tough job market. Just to give another area, and you know, could be about to tick off some friends, I'm gonna compare a couple states. Wisconsin and Colorado have about 5.5 million people each, and 2 law schools in their state. So 2 law schools per 5.5 million people. Ohio has double that population, 11 million, and 9 law schools. So the Ohio market, gosh, that just seems really saturated. It's 11 million people in the state. It's grown by about 0% in population over the past X years. It's not a growing state in the post-industrial era, yet it has so many more law schools per capita than other comparable mid to mid-large size states. So to the extent those law schools, if any of them are having a tough time, it's gonna be tougher for them to grab more market share of good students and more market share of jobs because they just have too much competition in that market. So there definitely are these regional effects that you wanna keep in mind in assessing the future prospects of a school.
Yeah. We talked a little bit about that last time, which we're trying not to overlap. So we haven't. There's only so much you can talk about with the rankings. We're not having some overlap, which is why Scott and I also want to shift gears a little bit and talk about why people should choose law schools. So I'll finish on a thought I had. Law schools do not reflect, by my estimation and experience in 17 years in this industry, they do not reflect very well the caliber of the student. They do not reflect very well at all the caliber of the teaching from the student's perspective. I'm not sure if I've ever walked out of a law school where I haven't heard the students talking about how brilliant their faculty are and how lucky they are to be there. People transfer, but students hardly ever transfer for my faculty aren't teaching me well. In 17 years of doing this, I have only heard that a handful of times. There was one school that was struggling mightily years ago where I think the students wanted out because of the teaching. Other than that, I really can't think of that. What I mentioned before and what I want to flesh out a little more is, and Scott and I talked about this last year too, but this matters. This is important to you. Law schools do correlate, prestige correlates with hiring, with outcomes, and you should care about outcomes, particularly because there's not a great way of measuring outcomes. There's not a precise measurement yet. Or precise recording, and not everyone—it's not apples to apples measurements yet. And Scott can talk about this. He talked about this some last year, but he has a wonderful insight because he was on the hiring committee at the firm he was at in New York City when he graduated from Harvard Law. Is that right?
Yeah. So I started my firm in New York. I became the hiring attorney, running the hiring process. And not to say made unilateral decisions, but I sort of administered the process and screened candidates. And if you're listening to this, you probably know the rankings better than almost all attorneys doing hiring at law firms or in government offices. But those attorneys and folks doing hiring will look at the rankings. So I literally got an applicant in around 2000 from someone who went to the University of Minnesota. I had literally no idea where the University of Minnesota was ranked, if it was a good school or not, because I just hadn't applied to it back in the day. So what I did is I actually looked up the rankings, and I didn't care about whether it was 19 or 22 that year. What I cared about is it a solid, good school, which it was. I knew it wasn't in about the top 5 or 6 because I would have known that already. So I cared about, is it in roughly the first tier? Is it a good school where they get good students? Or is it a school that's really struggling such that I don't know if a student who graduated there with middling grades really faced tough competition in getting some B's and B pluses? So I looked it up and it was a good school, and we then interviewed the candidate. So I have to admit that if the school had popped up as being in the mid-low second tier, I don't know if that candidate would have gotten the interview. That's a bit blunt, but when you're choosing among candidates and you're a hiring attorney and you have a big stack of resumes, it can be a tiebreaker that one student went to a better regarded law school than the other. And, you know, it's not, again, fine gradation, just is this a good law school, which correlates with what I sometimes see on student blogs. One thing I think students get right is there's a top 10 or 14, we could debate whether it's more like 10 or 14 that really are the prestige schools, and then there's a first tier, and then there's another cluster, and then there's the schools that are seen as somewhat more struggling, and that's probably about how I perceive it, that they're about, you know, 3 or 4 tiers, but it isn't by 50s.
Yeah, and it's not just law firms that do this. When I was also a dean of career services in my career, and when I was a dean of career services, I called the CIA. I wonder how I got their number. But I got in touch with the CIA, with their general counsel's office, and I was told that they only recruited at the top 10 schools, and the school I was at the time was like 17 or 18.
Some quality intelligence gathering by the CIA.
Yeah. So I was like, well, that's why I'm calling.
I wouldn't have to call you if I were at Yale.
Exactly. You weren't already coming. So I ended up meeting with someone in the legal office of the CIA.
Or so they told you.
Right. Well, her name was clearly a fake name, which was kind of hilarious. And then the woman who came and interviewed my students later didn't even give a name. Only gave the first name, which was also hilarious.
All these women told you they were named Mike.
Right. So I met with this woman in a hotel lobby because we couldn't meet at Langley. But the theme was, you know, you tell us why we should recruit from a top 20 school and not a top 10 school. Corporations had the same theme. So from that perspective, And outcomes should be, if you're a prospective student, if you're a law school student, outcomes should be, by my estimation, high up on your list of reasons why you choose a law school. But law schools primarily, and this now we're getting really into why what you should be looking at, law schools are regional. Okay, the vast majority of law schools are regional law schools. They place better in their region, and they place, I think the word is propinquity, they place better in their home state than they do out of their home state. Well, I mean, let's just where's the cutoff point? Maybe that's why there's a T14. I know the primary reason there's a T14 because for the last X number of years, and X is a large number, there hasn't been any exit points out of the top 14. Do you know how long that's been? It's been a long while.
It's been a long time.
Yeah. But if you also look at the top 14, let's look at the demarcation between 14 and 15. At 14, you have Georgetown. I don't have their data in front of me, but I would argue that Georgetown students are, again, to use the word propinquitous, they don't just cluster in D.C. Now, certainly they go to Georgetown for government and international and other reasons that are focal pointed in D.C. But if you have a degree from Georgetown and you want to practice international law, a California firm, you tell me, Scott, a California firm, I think, would be interested in you.
Yeah, the question, though, is that are the California firms going to go to Georgetown to interview? Because law firms, even the most well-heeled ones, they can only go do on-campus interviewing at so many schools. So, honestly, Harvard gets more New York firms interviewing on campus than Stanford, right? And vice versa.
Right,
now, obviously, both of those have super national reputations, but, you know, if you want to be in the South, you're probably better off going to Texas than Georgetown.
That's what I was getting at.
Exactly.
Right. So,
or Cornell, for example. Georgetown is close enough to the South, but like Cornell versus Texas?
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So, in a sense, and Scott Harp just mentioned this, in a sense, all law schools are regional. If you know you want to be in California and you get into Stanford and Harvard, I would have a strong inkling that if I just was talking to you on the phone and that was my one data point, to send you to Stanford. Or I can't send you anywhere, but to encourage you to go to Stanford.
Yeah, and I think that there are breakpoints. You know, there's literally a top, whether it's 6 or 8 or 10, where it literally doesn't matter. I think the New York firms go to Duke, for example, to interview, even though it's not
right next door. Right, UVA too.
Right, and they'll go to Stanford, right? So, and then there are schools that, you know, in the first year still send people around the country and draw students from around the country, but it can be fairly random. So one thing I'd say, beyond choosing law schools beyond U.S. News as the topic we're going with now, consider geography, but it's not just where you want to be. Look into whether the school really just draws only local students and therefore probably sends students only locally. Because if you're from out of state and want to go back out of state, there could be more limited opportunities. To do that, you're not going to have an alumni network where you are. So that's definitely a factor. So look into whether your school draws almost entirely from in-state. It's not just based on the rankings. So without getting into it, sometimes the biggest city schools, a really big school in a really big, one of the 4 or 5 big cities in the U.S., even if they're a top 20, 30 school, they might draw really disproportionately from that metro area because they can fill up from that metro area. And then that makes it a little hard to maybe leave that area because you don't have an alumni network to pitch you for jobs. Whereas there are schools that don't send people mostly locally or that draw more than half from out of state, and that can be a factor if you're from out of state.
Right. And the schools that, I mean, it's pathway dependency in a nutshell.
Right.
People that are getting people from their own region are sending people to their own region. So keep an eye on that. Let me put on my admissions hat for a second. So if you're a prospective student, this might be very interesting. When I was on the other side of things in admissions, I was thinking every day of my life, without there wasn't a day I took off, what is it that has people interested in our school? What is it that has people are compelled to attend our school? And how do we market this? So the point is this. I think that perhaps more importantly than anything, you should visit as many schools as you're looking at as possible.
Yeah.
But here's and I just went through an admissions open house, so it's a funny time to say this. But keep in mind that, how to say this, admissions people are hired to shake your hand and smile and market you to their school. And some are very good at that. And kudos to them. That means they're doing their job. It's, to me, it's the same thing as the visor, the viewfinder. Or the, if it's working, someone's doing their job. You could argue that the priorities are wrong, but if admissions people smile charismatically and shake your hand well and put on a wonderful admitted students day, because this is the time of year, I have scores of clients today at various admitted students programs. And I get lots of texts saying, I love NYU, it's vibrant, and Charlottesville blew me away. But you're getting a well-orchestrated red carpet treatment. I used to be in charge of the admitted students program at Vanderbilt, my former school. I was in charge of setting that up. And I started 6 to 7 months before the event, coordinating faculty schedules. And let me tell you, I didn't pick the faculty who had the best scholarship. I picked the faculty who all the students adore because they're young and charismatic and charming.
Is this for the talks or for mingling the students or?
For everything.
Interesting.
For every single thing, it was calculated on my end. We had a mock class, and the guy that did the mock class, I can't remember his name because he was only at Vanderbilt for a few years. He had worked at the CIA. This is becoming a CIA theme. And entered some sort of international something. Very young, African-American, handsome, outgoing, love students guy. And I wanted him in front of students because people loved him.
Yeah.
Right. And then the faculty we invited to the after hour cocktail party, whatever, were faculty that were relatable.
So yeah, what this gets to is that, you know, I'm strongly in favor, like Mike is, of visiting the school. You're going to spend enough in tuition, or if you have a full scholarship, hey, then you aren't paying tuition, so spring for it. It'll be the best $500 you ever spent to fly somewhere and stay in a cheap hotel for the night and visit. But what Mike's saying is, being a informed consumer, obviously there's the showmanship aspect. You know, we put out hard-boiled eggs and lovely pastries and coffee in the morning. You can buy those here, but we don't give them to you for free every morning of your life when you're a law student. So don't just go by, did you have a nice time in the visit? Go by, what do I actually need to learn? So did I learn that this is a nice building to be my office and where I'm basically my home away from home for 3 years? Is it a place, a region I could see living? And get specific answers. So when I talk to students, I'll talk to a zillion students while I'm doing this open house today and the other one we do. I'll ask, what can I tell you about the school that you want to know? And what I'm going for is, I know that, you know, we're putting on a good event for people. It's enjoyable, but what can I tell you that's tangible that you're going to leave here with that's actually useful information? And for that, you know, do your homework before you visit if you can. One thing I'll say is that it's fair to focus on what area of law you might be interested in if you have one, but don't go by whether a school has a center or a program. That largely reflects whether a faculty member in, say, health law has the juice with the dean to get declared a center. It's not like there's a separate building for it when they say there's a center in health law. It literally means the faculty member probably has a slush fund to bring in some speakers and stuff, and that's neat, you know, they can have some events. And it reflects probably that the school has more than one professor in the field. So take it for what it's worth, it means it's an area where the school has a full curriculum. But we live in, you know, the world where you can Google schools and figure out what schools have a good complement of professors and a good curriculum in a field. That's something you can figure out. And figure out, I'd say the order of business is figure out what you can by Googling and taking notes, and then ask the admissions folk or email one of the faculty members. You can email a faculty member out of the blue.
100%.
Absolutely.
I did it when I was looking at business schools.
Right. Now, if one faculty member doesn't answer, it could just be you pick the one jerky dude on the faculty, so don't hold it against the whole school.
Or a busy person.
Right, busy person or someone who's sick or out of town. For example, there's a intellectual property faculty member who just had a kid here 2 weeks ago. So if you email someone and they don't respond, it could be they just went in for surgery or had a kid, so don't think the school is full of jerks. But, you know, email a second person or admission saying, hey, I had questions about this. Schools should be able to get you answers to these questions, and you can find those answers, and you should.
Yeah. Interestingly enough, Scott mentioned not getting overly geeked up about a center because maybe it's a faculty member who has a slush fund. I've seen this play out firsthand, and if you're a law school dean listening to the podcast, Number one, we consult for law schools, and they have almost categorically gotten better in the things they want us to help them with. So please take a note of that. But more importantly, for this conversation, if you're a law school dean and you're listening in on this podcast, I have seen firsthand schools hire very splashy faculty hires from a 20th ranked school away from the number one or number two school to like a 20th ranked school, giving them whole centers and staffs and support staffs. And I have seen firsthand the prestige ranking get slightly worse the next year. Our inside joke at the school I was at when we did that was every school voted us the same except for the top two school that we stole the faculty member from, who gave us a worse voting because they were ranking in prestige.
Because they're mad about it. But it also means you do nothing for the students. So literally, again, without naming names, I can think of at least two places I know specifically, but I know this goes on more generally, where when they say they have a program in traffic law, just to pick an absurd field that nobody has, then when they say that they have a center in traffic law, what that sometimes literally means is that to poach a prestigious faculty member in the field from a better ranked school, they gave that faculty a $10,000 to $20,000 travel budget to go to events in the field. Right now, they may do other things with their money, like bring in speakers, and that'd be great. Right. But oftentimes, it's really just something they did to recruit the faculty member to say, you have a little fiefdom with research assistants and a travel budget. And maybe the students will benefit a little from some of the events, but not always necessarily.
So let's sum up first what you should, when you're trying to decide where to apply to, what you should be looking at, when you're trying to decide where to go, what you should be looking at. We'll sum it up quickly. And then I will give a little bit of a preview, maybe, of what I think is going to happen next year in the rankings. After we emphasize how the rankings have enduring hierarchies and how you should look at other things as well, I will sum up, because I know a lot of people are interested, I will project what I think might happen in the future for rankings.
I'm curious.
Yeah. Well, it's not... It is just a...
Well, the nice thing about making predictions that nobody will know the answer to in a year or longer is that you look like you're Nostradamus when you make it now, and nobody's going to remember that you're wrong. But if you're right, you can dig it up and say, see, I was right.
So last year, I wrote a blog article on 5 admissions predictions, and the first 3 came 100% true.
You see, and I forgot exactly. So I forgot until Mike is telling me the 3 that were right.
I ignore number 4 and 5, and I like to say that applications are up like I predicted. Applications are way up at the 165 and above bandwidths like I predicted, and I just ignore the things I predicted that didn't come true. So that's precisely right. In sum, we Scott and I agree that when you're looking at which schools to apply to, well, to begin with, have a modicum of realism. Every year also, I talk to a number of people who this time of year, I hate this phone call, and I get it a lot this time of year, is I applied to 3 schools or 5 schools, and it's Harvard, Stanford, Yale, and University of Alabama, because I'm from Alabama. And I'm waitlisted at Alabama, and I've been denied outright at Harvard, Stanford, and Yale. And what's going on? Well, I say, well, tell me a little bit about your background. And it's someone who just no conception that Harvard is getting 6,000, 7,000 applications, and it's self-selecting. Yale's only admitting 10% of their entering class, and that's 10% of a really strong applicant pool.
Right, even if Yale is looking beyond the simple numbers like GPA and LSAT, they have tons of applicants with an A average and the 170s. So in looking beyond the numbers, that's whom they'll take with a 168.
Exactly. Right. I haven't been in administration at a top 10 law school, but I was at 2 top 20 law schools. And we had file drawers upon file drawers full of waitlisted people with a 4.0.
Right.
So if my school's median at the time was a 168 LSAT, did some of those people with a 4.0 stand out on the waitlist? Of course they did, but they stood out more if they had a 166 and a 4.0 on the waitlist than if they had a 150 and a 4.0.
Right.
So have some sort of realistic preview of where you're going to apply to. I love people that punch well above their weight, of course. Don't sell yourself short. In 17 years of talking to people with a lot of admissions, I've never talked anyone out of applying to their dream school.
But I say that, if you're applying to reaches, apply to relatively more reaches because you never know which will happen to like something of yours.
Right. This cycle, things were a little bit more challenging than last cycle, so people who applied to some safeties this cycle are glad they did. Not every person, but some people.
These applications are up nationally by at least low single digits, right?
Yeah, 1.8%.
Right.
But they're just up, they're up substantially at the top law schools.
Right.
Right, to the top-ranked law schools.
And you never know which school has a big jump in their applicant pool and therefore is going to get pickier.
Right, right. So so there's that. Be realistic. Look at where you want. If you have an idea of where you want to practice, look at where you want to practice and look at the fungibility, the transferability of that school's diploma. Versus
right. Ask them about people coming from out of state and going back out of state.
Right. I would recommend, and this is where I was going with this whole admitted student stuff, I would recommend visiting not on an admitted student's program day. I tell this to my clients. The advantage of visiting during admitted student's program is you get this, in some sense, meet some of your future cohort at law school. And that makes people feel a little bit good about themselves and prepared for the first couple weeks of awkwardness that are like high school all over
again. But that's a good idea because, you know, the admitted student's day, you'll get more information at once. But if you're visiting many schools, then on the whole, you're getting a lot of information about law schools,
right.
Many which overlaps among schools, many pieces of information. So if you visit on a day that's not admitted student's day, I can't speak to all schools. And tell me if your schools did this. If you want to come visit Colorado Law, we recommend not a Friday because we have fewer classes, but Monday to Thursday. No, we do it on Fridays, right. Literally any day of the week. We have certain professors we pre-cleared. You know, for me, it's my Wednesday con law. I'm always going to have 2 to 4 admitted students sitting in. I just tell them if it's more than 5, because then I have to tell students to move their seats or something,
right.
Which is fine. But most schools can, or at least should, do that. Do you think most do that?
Yeah, I think most schools have very similar admissions flirtatious structures.
Right.
So they flirt with you in a similar way, which is why I like for people to visit not during admitted student's day and email a faculty like Scott recommended. And the faculty, more likely than not, if they have time, will have coffee with you at their law school. Talk to that faculty. You know, ostensibly you're emailing the faculty because they have some sort of, they're doing something that you're interested in.
Yeah, a lot of what I get is, you know, either the admissions officer or IS chair will get, hi, I'm interested in environmental law. Can I come sit in on a class and also meet one of the professors in the field? And, you know, it'll depend on who's available that week. But yes, I'll email, you know, the 4 or 5 folks who are vaguely in that field and see who's free that day.
Right. And then talk to students. Please, let me just assure you of one thing. People who are going to be lawyers or lawyers generally like to talk about themselves.
People generally.
Yeah, people. Right. That's a good point. Particularly law school admissions consultants. But if you ask a student, hey, do you have 10 minutes? I'm curious what your favorite part of this law school is and what the challenges you found at this law school is. There is a strong degree of certainty. I have a strong degree of certainty that they will spend 10 minutes if they have time talking to you about that. That is much better than the law school putting their 20 most likable students in front of you to tell you about why they chose this school over all other schools. They're all saying the same thing. They all chose that school. So I would just say get the law school admissions offices out of their orchestrated comfort zone. And visit when you can get a feel for it on your own.
And the other thing you do is if you go for admitted student's day, for example, ours is Friday today. But if you came a day early, you could have done what Mike said to say, you know, can I mill around the cafe and chat with some students on the Thursday, for example?
Yeah, don't even ask admissions. Just do it.
Yeah.
You're admitted.
Building.
They don't want you not at their school. I can promise you that. Anything else for how people should pick schools?
No, I think that about covers it.
So here's a prediction. It's.
And what were your 3 good predictions from last year?
I can't remember the third. I would have to pull up my blog.
That's okay, which are the ones you remember?
For the first time in 5 years that applications would be up.
Okay, 6 good.
Cycles. And that applications were going to be dramatically up at the 165 to 180 range, and they are. In some sense, that second one was a very easy prediction because they were dramatically down the year before.
Right, that's the plexiglass principle.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think that they'll level out some next year. I think next year will be a slightly, for at least at the higher end, the top 20 schools, I think next year will be a slightly easier cycle, less competitive cycle than this year. So if you look at the rankings and if you look at what happened, there was very little change in the metrics that U.S. News and World Report measured. I think the only change that Scott and I have even noticed, I mean, there's more granular, they do more granular measurement that we don't even know about that they don't say publicly. But the only one I noticed was that they 10 months out of employment versus 9 months out. And you'll see that there was, if you look at, and we have this on our blog, it's from March 9th, 2016, the top 100 schools and which were up and which were down and by how many. If there's just in the top 19, there's very little movement, hardly any movement. So what I think is going on, when there's not movement among the flashy schools, I am going to conjecture that there's less interest in the rankings. Right? There has to be change for magazines to sell. I think we've been due for a while now, a large change in some sort of metric. So for example, there's been more and more public outcry, arguably, for the spending per student metric of the rankings, which incidentally U.S. News doesn't even show that in their public version of what they're accounting for. But there's a student expenditure, it's like an FTE student expenditure. And I wouldn't be surprised if you just see that completely go away. Well, what would happen if that happened? For the first time in anyone's memory, you might see Yale drop from number one, because Yale has been so much more per student than any other school. So much more, because of the small student ratio. That even if that metric were greatly de-emphasized, it's already not emphasized that much, but Yale spends so much more, they get such a return of their investment on it.
And mathematically, that would tend to favor, if they dumped spending per student, because it's per student, right?
Yeah.
Dumping it would tend to favor big schools.
That's right.
And it would tend to favor probably public schools too, on average.
Yep.
So Colorado, you know, it'd be a wash for us because we're a small school and a public school. But right. Yeah, I guess, you know, the big schools, the schools with 400, 500 people, there's certain administrative expenses that it's efficient that they diffuse it over many students, but they take a hit for that in U.S. News.
Yeah. This is pure conjecture, but I think that we're due for some sort of large metric change. At least, I guess if I was running U.S. News and World Report, I would be considering that for business reasons.
Makes sense.
So let's look for it next year. Any final thoughts, comments, criticisms, or otherwise, Scott?
No, that basically covers it. Good luck applying. You know, I know we're at the end of the application season being April 1st. One thing I'll add is that if you're getting back some decisions and, like Mike said, you're someone who didn't get what you want, you applied to a range of schools and didn't pan out, some schools, if you email and ask nicely, will let you apply even a bit after the deadline. So if you haven't got what you wanted, you can still do it. You can always ask. The worst case is that you'll spend 60 seconds Googling an email address, sending an email, and the answer will be no. But if you apply, for example, to take that example, Alabama, Stanford, Harvard, Yale, and you got one waitlist and three no's, you know, email the 10 of the schools you probably should have applied to from the start. And out of those 10, I would guess that, you know, somewhat more than two, but fewer than eight are going to say yes.
It might be eight or nine.
It could be.
Yeah, if you're particularly
in the down years, it would have been.
That's right. We have noticed that firsthand that schools are being a little
because there's some schools that are full up now, and they'll say no thanks. They might say politely, but yeah, I mean, you will get some yeses. In other words,
well, I won't name any schools, but you would be surprised at the high end caliber of schools that have taken fresh applications as late as June and July in the past. On that note, we are signing off. We'll see you next year.
All right, thanks, folks.